ॐ सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सहवीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः हरिः ॐ टुडेस् topic is Swami Vivekananda's contribution to world thoughts. It's a very serious subject for students of academic philosophy and also for students of religious philosophy. Now, when you look at Swami Vivekananda, what do you find in him? He was not an academic philosopher. The way you associate with India's traditional philosophical heritage. In India, there were two schools of philosophy, mainly speaking. One is the orthodox, the theistic, those who accepted Vedas as an important testimony, as an important tool of epistemology, theory of knowledge, and those who did not accept the Vedas as an important means for valid knowledge. The orthodox schools are supposed to be six in number. The Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Sankhya Yoga, Purva Mimamsa and Uttara Mimamsa, of which the last mentioned one is known as Vedanta in popular language. Then there were six other schools of thought which were either agnostic or heterodox. All of them did not deny the existence of God, but they did not look upon the Vedas as an important, as the most important means for valid knowledge. In their epistemology, they did not give much importance to the revealed scriptures of any kind. Mostly the four schools of Buddhism, the two schools of realism called Sautrantika and Vaibhashika, which is allied to the Hinayana, traditional ascetic Buddhist school. The other one was the schools of realism, which belong to the Mahayana tradition, Shunyavada and Vijnanavada. So today when you hear and read about this mindfulness or vipassana meditation, all these are more or less allied to the two realistic schools. And some of them, of course, have connection with the idealistic schools also. Now, when you come to Vivekananda, you find he was not a traditional philosopher of the theistic or the orthodox or the heterodox, the agnostic tradition. Because you find him on the one hand a great theistic philosopher, but also some very other important features which are not normally associated with the six teachers of theistic schools, that is Jaimini of Purva Mimamsa, Vyasa of Uttara Mimamsa, then the Gautama of Nyaya, Indian school of logic, and in Indian atomism called Vaisheshika, which was expounded by Kanada, and then Sankhya and Yoga. Sankhya school was originally expounded by Kapila, and Yoga school was originally expounded by Patanjali. So they were all great thinkers, and Vivekananda had studied, he was indebted to all these schools. But at the same time, there was something much more in him that makes him relevant, not only in academic philosophy, but also in certain very other extended areas like social reform, women's empowerment, spreading of literacy, synthesis and harmony of different national and cultural values, a unique concept of universal religion, interfaith, interspirituality, and humanism. All these ideas you find in Vivekananda, which you do not so clearly find in the theistic schools of Indian philosophy or the agnostic schools, the heterodox schools. On the other hand, he was totally and absolutely completely different from all the main schools of Western thought. You find in him the influence of Hume. You find him the influence of Bentham, J.S. Mill, Spinoza, Kant, Hegel, Schopenhauer, and so on. But at the same time, he did not belong to any of these categories, because his philosophy was originally a kind of religious philosophy, which cannot be said about anybody other than Spinoza and Eckhart, because Augustine and other theologians are frequently not considered to be academic philosophers by many modern historians of Western thoughts. So in Vivekananda you find certain unique features. I don't say that it makes him superior to all of them. No, you should not get away with that impression. Because there were certain reasons why Swami Vivekananda's philosophy or his thought system had all these apparently diverse and mutually contradictory features. You find him talking about the need to reform the institution of marriage. You find him talking about the need to ban child marriage. You find him talking about the need to spread education among the masses. And you find him talking about the importance of spreading secular education, the importance of organizing the certain unique Western, I would say more precisely American values like egalitarianism, the democratic spirit, the need for organized philanthropy, the need for doing organized work among the people suffering from different natural calamities. You find all these very, very radical ideas you find in him, which put him in a special category. And then, above all that, his most lasting and maybe the most important contribution in Indian context was his reinterpretation of Vedanta. In a simple sentence, we can say he gave a humanistic impulse, a humanistic orientation to Vedantic thought. That was his most significant contribution. He did not write such philosophical masterpieces like those written by Shankaracharya. He did not find so many monastic orders, only one monastic order, which again was a continuation of one of the 10 monastic orders founded by Shankaracharya in 8th century. But at the same time, Vivekananda, the religious philosopher, was as concerned about the secular realities, the realities of people living in this world, eradication of poverty, eradication of social and economic backwardness, the need to get rid of social injustices like casteism and untouchability. So you find all these in Vivekananda, which place him in a different category, as I mentioned earlier. Now, when you place him somewhere in the category of world thinkers, as I mentioned, he was a religious philosopher with a strong humanistic bent, with a strong emphasis on social reform. Now, when you think of philosophy proper, as it is called in Western context, we have to remember, you know, philosophy was practically dead right from 5th century AD with the emergence of Augustinian theology, maybe up to around 18th century in Europe. So, philosophy was dominated or was just buried by theology. And as a result of this, with the Enlightenment, later Renaissance, with the emergence of philosophical backlash from Britain, from Locke, Hume and others, and from Germany, like Kant, Hegel and others, there was a strong backlash. They wanted to liberate philosophy from the stranglehold of theology. As a result, you find this emphasis on the separation of the church and state. In certain countries like France and Germany, and of course much more emphatically in southern European countries like Spain, Portugal, etc., education was completely in the hands of the established church. And many of the great universities were actually, essentially, they were centers of theological learning. So, with the Enlightenment and Renaissance, with the discovery of new sea routes, and with the Industrial Revolution, there was a great emphasis to liberate philosophy from the stranglehold of church or theology. So that's why very often there was an eagerness to denigrate any philosopher who spoke about God and scriptures, to denigrate or degrade him to what they consider to be a lower rank, as his only theology. But in India's context, the greatest philosophical mind of India was also apparently the greatest system builder in the history of Hinduism, Shankaracharya. Nobody wrote more profound books on philosophy in India than Shankara, and was also a great temple builder, a great system builder, a great founder of innumerable monastic orders, which still flourish, and whose adherents, even today in this 21st century, visit all over Europe and America and Australia and Canada and Latin America and everywhere. They're all followers of one of the 10 monastic orders founded by Shankaracharya in 8th century. So philosophy and theology were not so strongly demarcated one from the other, not so much, so clearly differentiated in Indian context as it was in Europe, because in Europe, the domination, the dictatorial tyranny of religious leaders, the church, theology, over philosophy, practically led to a backlash from independent thinkers in Europe who actually started a new movement to permanently separate the state and philosophy, reason, thinking, enlightenment from faith and religion and theology. So that's an important point to remember when you talk about the contributions of Vivekananda. As the important point is very, 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 very much to be emphasized. Because in Indian context, you cannot think of any great philosopher without some connection with a great spiritual religious tradition. So you cannot actually draw any line of demarcation between theology and philosophy. And that's because, as Shankaracharya says, genuine philosophy need not remain in mortal fear of an attack from theology. You need not be afraid of God if you are a real philosopher, Indian context. So Shankaracharya's slogan was this: Srutya, Yuktya, Swanubhutya. First you read, listen to scriptures. Don't blindly believe in what the scriptures say. This is teaching of Vedanta. So you don't find anything comparable to creationistic theories in Indian history, which I am going to. That the Hindu equivalent, Vedantic equivalent of creationism, stands somewhere between Darwin's evolutionary theories and the ecclesiastical, the Christian concept of creationism. But if the scriptures tell you that God created this world 6,000 years back, Shankaracharya will tell you, don't listen unless you use your brain. Don't care a damn for what the scriptures say. Use your intelligence. Srutya, yuktya. Yukti means intelligence and reason. I don't think there is any religious system, philosophical system in the world where the greatest religious teacher tells you, don't listen to me, if it doesn't apply to your reason, your intelligence. You don't have to believe. Because the moment you believe first, the moment you're asked to believe, and not to ask question, philosophy is dead. Reason is dead. That's what happened when Augustine came. The radical sinfulness of man. Somewhere long back, Adam ate the apple. Said, so today you're all inheritors of this accumulated sin, you know. No, and you should believe in that. Shankara would say, don't, no, I won't believe in that. It doesn't appeal to my reason. This is very yuktiya. So first use the scripture, the verbal testimony as it is called in the language of epistemology. Vedanta believed in six epistemological tools: direct perception, inference, analogy or comparison, verbal testimony, presumption, and negation. And in fact, these six was further extended to 10. They were all included in some sort of inference, you know. Like, for example, mythology, hearsay, external gestures, like, you know, Cheshta, Parisesha, deduction, all these. So, Sambhava, Aitihya, Cheshta, and Parisesha. So, Pratyaksha, Anumana, Vabana, Shabda, Arthapatya, Anubalabdhi. Six Pramana, six means of epistemology for Vedanta, and four extra, which in a way can be included within the umbrella of inference. That is Anumana. That is Sambhava, Aitihya, Cheshta, and Parisesya. But anyway, what I'm coming to that, such a huge, elaborate epistemology. And epistemology means you are totally free to ask, to compare, to analyze, and reject if you don't want to accept. And not only that, then Shankaracharya is Swanubhutya. Then you should have some sort of experience. You should be a fact in your life. Then only you can accept as a fact. Accept it as a truth, facts. Now, therefore, because of this, there was no scope for a perpetual polemical, dialectical warfare between theology and philosophy in Indian context. Because no churchman, no temple goer, no priest worshipping in the temple would ever dare tell a philosopher, believe in me. No. A philosopher can say, I don't believe in you. So that was the greatness of philosophical tradition in India. In this context, where do you place Vivekananda? As I mentioned, Vivekananda was essentially a religious philosopher. From a Western perspective, his contribution was tremendous because his teachings and his ideas, on the one hand, actually inaugurated a new era of interfaith, interfaith harmony. The idea that if your religion is different from my religion, it doesn't mean that you are wrong, it only means you are different. This idea was for the first time proclaimed in the Parliament of World Religion in Chicago. Now, you should remember one interesting thing. This idea was not so eagerly welcomed by all the great delegates who attended the Parliament of Religion. We should not get away with the impression that Vivekananda's pluralism, his interfaith harmony, or his idea of universal religion, universal tolerance, was all welcomed and appreciated by everyone. No. See, in the Parliament of Religion itself, there was a great Christian scholar, his name was John H. Barrows, who was responsible for the publication of the Proceedings of the Parliament of Religion of 1893. So, he was the chairman of the General Committee of the Parliament. Himself, he was a great Christian, a great respected Christian. So, and he was, in fact, for those days, he was an extremely refined, well-educated, a tolerant person. And in spite of his best efforts, the Archbishop of Canterbury refused to participate in this Parliament of Religion. And so also, the Pope sitting in the Vatican also did not send a representative. And the then Khalifa of the Islamic world, the Turkish Sultan, also did not participate or send a delegate to the Parliament of Religion. Archbishop Canterbury did not participate. The supreme head of the international Islamic body, the Sultan of Turkey, did not participate. But there were many highly enlightened Americans. That was a glorious time. If you ask me personally a question, what was the most glorious period of America? I would say the last decade of 19th century. If you want any proof, you can read the newspapers published in those days. There was no social media. All these great newspapers published in big letters the events taking place in perhaps the most profound, the most serious session, philosophical discussion, debate taking place in 19th century. Today, if there is a very serious philosophical debate going on in any part of the country, do you think New York Times, I am no offense meant, any printed media will dare to publish those events with so much of prominence? When philosophy, spirituality, discussion on higher values are published, it shows that the general public have a very high level of intellectual refinement. But even that Dr. Barrows, who was actually the chairman of the committee, he says, the parliament has shown that Christianity is still the great quickener of humanity, the most tolerant intellectual of those days. This was as far as he could go. That it is now educating those who do not accept its doctrines, that there is no teacher to be compared with Christ. That's where you... In fact, after the parliament was over, the great intellectuals of Europe and America, after listening to Vivekananda's ideas, began to believe, yes, Christ was certainly one of the greatest teachers of the world, but there are other teachers also as great as Christ. Christianity is a great religion, but Buddhism, Hinduism, all these are also other great traditions. So this new paradigm shift began with this first Parliament of Religion.
Dr. Barros continues, the non-Christian world may give us some valuable criticism and confirm scriptural truths and make excellent suggestions as to Christian improvement, but it has nothing to add to the Christian creed. Now, this was as far as Dr. Barros, who was perhaps the most educated and refined intellectual participating in the, who was part of the office, the directors, the office bearers, the parliament committee could go. So that's something very interesting. Now, there are a few more other very interesting observations that we can see that should give us a glimpse of Vivekananda's contribution. He was a great British Indologist. His name was A.L. Basham, Arthur Llewellyn Basham. He wrote a well-known book, The Wonder That Was India. Now, this is just one of the books. After this Parliament of Religion, you find a large number of American and European intellectuals took to studying not only Vedanta and Hinduism, but also Buddhism, Jainism and other traditions. So the Basham says about Vivekananda, he says, even now 100 years after the birth of Vivekananda, it is very difficult to evaluate his importance in the scale of world history. It is certainly far greater than any Western historian or most Indian historians would have suggested at the time of his death. Not only the great books of Huxley, Basham, and Fitzjeff Capra, many others, even today, if you look at the intellectual, the cultural, the spiritual landscape of America and Europe, you find a large number of Oriental or Eastern spiritual religious organizations and teachers flooding this country. Paramahamsa Yogananda came, and then of course T.M. this Maharshi Mahesh Yogi came, Swami Chinmayananda came, and many other teachers came. They were all actually trying to follow the footsteps laid by Vivekananda. So on the one hand, from the West, great thinkers like George Santayana, William James, and many others, Professor Goldberg, who is coming for our Olima Memorial Day program, is also well known for his wonderful works, American Vedas, and so on. Now, these are some of the contributions from the Western intellectuals. From Eastern tradition, you find Gandhi, Dr. Radhakrishnan, as I mentioned, Swami Chinmayananda, all these great intellectuals who came to this country were directly or indirectly following the footsteps laid by Vivekananda. So Basham continues, the passing of the years and the many stupendous and unexpected events which have occurred since then suggest that in centuries to come, Vivekananda will be remembered as one of the main moulders of the modern world, especially as far as Asia is concerned, and as one of the most significant figures in the whole history of Indian religion, comparable to Shankaracharya and others. Now, I'm not going that far, but I mean to say, the quotation is too long, but I mean to say, on the one hand, you find this great broadening of perspectives. The idea that if your religion is different from my religion, it doesn't mean that you are wrong, that I alone am right. Rather, both are two different approaches in search of the same truth. This idea actually came from Swami Vivekananda. Now, what was the intellectual, cultural, scientific landscape that welcomed Vivekananda in 1893 when he came? In 1859, Charles Darwin published his Origin of Species, and Origin of Species. And with that, that says in 1859, the foundation of evolutionary biology, the process of natural selection. which actually laid the foundation of what we now understand as evolutionism, in contrast to creationism. Now, it was a great shock because it shook the foundations of Abrahamic concepts of creation. Genesis was no more scientifically relevant. Of course, this is just one view. There was a lot of criticism against this. But still, it challenged the creation concepts of Abrahamic tradition. Now, Swami Vivekananda has something else to say about the origin of the world. On the one hand, you find in the Sankhya Yoga tradition, you find idea that there's a gradual manifestation of multiple elements in the world, right from Pragati, Mahatattva, Ahankara, then from the Rajasika, Tamasika, and Satya Ahankara's mind, its Indriya, senses, the five elements, the whole phenomenal world evolves. This is the evolutionary theory of the Sankhya Yoga tradition. But there was something else that Swami Vivekananda put forward, which actually caught the attention of many philosophers, not only Darwinian thinkers, but also philosophers. You find in the writings of Aldous Huxley and Julian Huxley and other later writers and thinkers references to Vivekananda's concept of creation taken directly from the Advaitic teachings of Shankaracharya. So in Vedanta, this world is not absolutely real, but it is not absolutely unreal. It is relative. So anything that undergoes change every day, every moment, you cannot say it is totally unreal because we experience it. But we don't experience it the same way for all time. Therefore, it is not real if we use the word capital letter R. Because to be considered to be absolutely real, it should remain the same without any change in the past, in the present, and in the future. So the world that we see doesn't remain like that. It goes on changing. So how do you accommodate this Darwinian theory? We reject that the world was created 6,000 years back. And at the same time, how do you reconcile that this world is much older? It may be billions or millions of years old, which is what modern science tells you. So how do you reconcile this? Vivekananda says, this world of changes is a relative entity. With Vedanta is called Vyavaharika Satta, which is an empirical reality. It goes on changing. So his idea that this world is a magic. So there is a very interesting statement in Shankaracharya's commentary, which is nothing but a very graphic description of a most unlikely subject called Indian rope trick. You might have heard of this. Even old books you find. Indian rope trick. Certain books published in 19th century by British travelers talk about it, and some of the old publications will have drawings of this. A magician comes and throws a rope to the sky, and he makes people believe that he climbs up the rope and goes somewhere, disappears, and then there's a big battle going on in the heavens. And there is a big war going on. People are dying. The dead bodies fall. And after some time, they find a magician is laughing, standing behind. But the gullible people, at least for some time, believe that this world is, that all these happenings were real. Now, if you go to Disneyland, or if you go to a good movie, for 3 hours, you will forget the real world in which you live. You forget the counter from where you bought your tickets, and you'd be living in a different world for 3 hours. Now, can you say that the world in which you live for 3 hours is unreal? It was, you realize its unreality when you come out of it. When you are sitting in the movie theater, watching the movie, or when you are watching and enjoying the events in Disneyland, those events are real, the outer world is unreal for you. You realize the unreality of what you really thought to be real in the movie theater only when you come outside. Like that, Vedanta tells you, this world, you may live for 100 years. Well, it's a matter of change of difference in degrees. For 3 hours, you enjoy a movie and you live within that. You live in that world and you think those events taking place in the movie are real. Like that, you live in this world maybe for 100 years. The world is much older. So, it is a changing, a relative phenomenon. Now, this idea was something very interesting. So, what Vivekananda taught was, there is a different interpretation of the world, different from both Darwinian evolutionary theory and also from the ecclesiastical or the biblical creationism. So, now, these are some of the very interesting ideas which caught the attention of many of the great thinkers. Now, as I mentioned earlier, one of Vivekananda's greatest contribution in Indian context was reinterpretation of the ancient Vedanta philosophy. And while doing that, he also speaks about the need to spread education, literacy among the women folk, among the downtrodden people, the need to eradicate social injustices, inequality, all that. And now, can you ever find a great academic philosopher, either in Indian context or maybe in Western context, who spoke about women's rights on property, the need to spread the values of women's empowerment, the need to educate, give secular education for the common people? One of Vivekananda's greatest contribution was this. He said, you may have the highest philosophy, but still, if the society is poor, backward, and superstitious, steeped in economic and social backwardness, then whatever may be your philosophical or spiritual heritage, it doesn't matter much. So, no matter how great, how profound your philosophical heritage may be, or your spiritual tradition may be, still, unless you are able to evolve an egalitarian society where people have got minimum education, and especially his emphasis on women's education, that's a very, very important message that he gave. In fact, I can quote some very interesting teachings from Mahabharata, which must have influenced Swami Vivekananda. I'm quoting actually what could be called the most powerful document on women's empowerment. So if you read Swami Vivekananda's Colombo to Elmira lectures, where he strongly criticizes the orthodox people, the traditional priestcraft, for keeping the poor, the downcast, and the women folk outside the pale of social benefits. And he comes down with some very strong language, which I cannot even quote. One of his statements may shock you. I am a socialist, not because it's a perfect system, but because half a loaf is better than no bread.
the Vivekananda. And again, he himself had to go through, himself had to witness some of the most tragic events in his own family. And also, that was the time when the province that he was coming from, that he was born, actually was going through a phase of social reform. It was inaugurated by the great social reformers like Raja Ramamohan Roy, and later followed by Devendranath Tagore, Kesava Chandra Sen, and others who actually fought hard for banning child marriage, and also even some of the most diabolical practices like sati, called chai widow burning, which was, don't ever get away with the wrong notion that it was spread everywhere. There were certain small pockets of India where in 19th century even widow burning was practiced, and Raja Ramamohan Roy was a social reformer who founded a very well-known organization called Brahma Samaj, of which Vivekananda was a member. And some of the members of this social reform movement were devotees of Sri Ramakrishna. And Vivekananda said that in your philosophical tradition, your spiritual tradition, you should accommodate values like egalitarianism, equality between women and men, and so on. So one statement comes in the Mahabharata which tells you that a society or a family or an institution or an organization or a nation which does not honor women folk is doomed. A strong statement comes from Mahabharata. So Swamiji knew that the ancient Hindu scriptures emphasized, were very emphatic on respect and honor for the women folk. Education for girls as much as for boys. But over the centuries, many of these great values were lost or forgotten. And one of Vivekananda's greatest contribution to Indian thought was bringing this idea of social reform between his Vedantic philosophical superstructure. Vedanta essentially was more or less an individualistic philosophy of spiritual liberation, spiritual enlightenment before Vivekananda. And Vivekananda's contribution to Vedanta was that he gave a new interpretation to this ancient spiritual philosophical tradition. But while giving this new interpretation, he brought in this unique element of women's empowerment and spreading secular education. He says, Mahabharata Anushasana Parva, one important, he says, Pidribhi Madribhishchabhi Sosurehi Atadevarehi Pooja Bhushaidavyascha Bhukukalyanepsubhi. And I am quoting from Mahabharata, which you can place somewhere maybe 3000 BC. So those who believe that, or who wrongly believe that Vivekananda was giving a new idea, Swamiji himself would have disowned it, because he himself said what he did was he wanted to bring India back to some of the ancient spiritual values that prevailed in this country, in India, maybe in 3000 BC. So I'm quoting from the Mahabharata where it is said that ladies, women folk should be honored. Where they are not honored, that country, that race, that nation, that family will perish. That's a strong statement. So Pitribhi Madribhishchabhi Shusurehi Adadevarehi Pooja Bhushaidavyascha Bhukukalyanepsubhi. I shall read the translation later. Pujyaha Lalaidavyascha Striyo Nityam Janadhiva Striyocha Yatra Pujyante Ramante Tatra Devadaha Apujidascha Yatra Edaha Sarva Tatra Phala Kriyaha Tadacha Edat Kulam Vasti Yada Shochanti Jamayaha Jami Shaptani Gehani Nikrundani Vakritteya Naiva Bhanti Navardhante ശ്രിയാ ഹീനാനി പാർത്ഥിവ സ്ത്രീയസ്തു മാനമർഹന്തി താ മാനയത മാനവാഹ സ്ത്രീ പ്രത്യയോ ഹവൈ ധർമ്മോ രതിർഭോഗശ്ച കേവലാഹ പരിചര്യ നമസ്കാര തദായന്ത ഭവന്തു വഹ
ഉത്പാദനം അപത്യസ്യ ജാതസ്യ പരിലാളനം സമന്യമാന ചേതാഹ ഹി സർവകാരുണ്യവാപ്സ്യത സ്ത്രീ ഏത സ്ത്രീയോ നാമ സത്കാര്യ ഭൂതിമിച്ചത. നൗ യു ആർ വോണ്ട് മിസ് എനിത്തിങ് ഐ ഷാൽ ട്രാൻസ്ലേറ്റ് ദിസ് ഇൻ ടു ഇംഗ്ലീഷ്. ഹിയർ ഈസ് എ ഗ്രേറ്റ് പ്രൊക്ലമേഷൻ ആൻഡ് എ പ്രൊക്ലമേഷൻ ഇസ് ദിസ്: പേരൻസ്, ബ്രദേഴ്സ്, ഫാദേഴ്സ് ഇൻ ലോ ആൻഡ് ബ്രദേഴ്സ് ഇൻ ലോ ഹു ആർ ആങ്ഷ്യസ് അബൌട്ട് ദേർ ഓൺ വെൽഫെയർ, അബൌട്ട് ദ വെൽഫെയർ ഓഫ് ദെയർ ഫാമിലി, ഷുഡ് ടേക്ക് കെയർ to treat their women folk at home and outside, everywhere, with honor and respect, and satisfy their legitimate demands for ornaments, etc. They should be worshipped and treated with love and consideration always. Where women are thus honored, the entire gods feel pleased.
Yatra daryastha pujante tatra deva tat തത്ര ദേവ രമന്തിച്ച എത്ര ഏദാസ്തു ന പൂജന്തേ തത്ര സർവ ഫലാക്രിയ. സ്റ്റേറ്റ്മെന്റ് വിച്ച് ഐ എം കോട്ടിംഗ്, വേർ വിമൻ ആർ ഓണേർഡ് ആൻഡ് റെസ്പെക്ടഡ് ആൻഡ് ടേക്കൻ കെയർ ഓഫ്, ദർ ഈവൻ ദ ഗോഡ്സ് ആർ പ്ലീസ്ഡ്. വേർ ദേ ആർ നോട്ട് പ്രോപ്പർലി ഓണേർഡ്, വാട്ട് എവർ യു ഡു വിൽ ഗോ ഇൻ വെയിൻ. നൗ ദിസ് ഡോക്യുമെന്റ് ഈസ് നോട്ട് ഫ്രം ദ ലേറ്റസ്റ്റ് കോൺസ്റ്റിറ്റ്യൂഷൻ. It comes from a 3rd millennium BC document. And Vivekananda must have read all this. So he says, when he interpreted Vedanta to accommodate or accommodating humanistic values, egalitarian values, democratic values, he was giving a new contribution. In fact, it is said by historians, and if you read Vivekananda's life, you'll find Vivekananda read the works of J.S. Mill, John Stuart Mill, and Jeremy Bentham. So, and also Hume. So the humanistic ideas. And as he was an avid leader of philosophy and history, and he was well-versed especially in the history of French Revolution, which is a textbook for university students in those days. Now, Carlyle concludes his book with Bourbons never forgot anything because they never, no, sorry, the Bourbons never forgot anything because they never tried to learn anything. So, what Vivekananda, when Vivekananda talks about the need for giving a humanistic interpretation to a spiritual philosophy, he must be familiar with these ancient statements. The statements continue. Where women are thus honored, their entire gods feel pleased. If they are thus honored, all attempts to satisfy the gods' rituals will be accepted. Where they are not honored, all rituals will be of no use. Those families where they suffer cease to be homes are to be burned away by the fire of their silent curse. Strong language, you know. And it continues. Therefore, O men, honor every woman, for women deserve such honor. All dharma and worldly prosperity depend upon them, as also the production and protection of your whole society. Obtain whatever you desire without giving up your duty of honoring women. Women indeed are the personifications of Lakshmi, the embodiment of wealth and also learning. Now, you find such statements in the ancient scriptures. So when you read Vivekananda, a religious philosopher, a monk, talking about the need to spread education among the women folk, you should remember Vivekananda was familiar with these ideas. Now, after this, I'm going to discuss a much more relevant topic, especially in this particular context, Vivekananda's interpretation of, or rather reinterpretation of Vedanta. Now, what was Vivekananda's contribution? There are quite a few modern Western writers
who have tried to analyze Vivekananda's contribution to Vedanta. They belong to two categories. The one group has studied Vivekananda. They have given a very legitimate criticism, analysis, and with the proper understanding. And another group, like Will Weber, etc., they were sometimes Christian apologists. They try to take everything from Vivekananda's idea, like universal religion and practical Vedanta, and then they would say that Vivekananda learned all this during his travels in Europe and America. Swami Vivekananda, in his own writings, have stated that he learned many great lessons mostly from America and much less from Europe. See, when he traveled in this country, he was struck with certain very special features of organized philanthropical activities, like taking care of the health of the poor. And I shall drive home this idea further. One Swami who came to San Francisco in maybe 1920s, inspired by Vivekananda, went back to Calcutta and started the child a hospital for pregnant women. It was a revolutionary, radical concept. And that is the biggest hospital run by the Ramakrishna Mission in India. So you can imagine what they learned when they lived in this country, and what Vivekananda learned when he traveled in this country giving lectures all over the place. Organization, discipline, organized philanthropy, taking care of the poor and the women folk, etc. Now, that is sometimes completely forgotten by many of these apologists who try to tell you that Vivekananda started an entirely new philosophical paradigm which had nothing to do with India's traditional Vedantic heritage. Swami Vivekananda himself used to repeat again and again that whatever he did, whatever he preached, was from the Upanishads. He said, "I didn't preach anything but the Upanishads, the Vedantic scripture, the Vedic scripture." If there was any good that came out of his preaching, it was because of the grace of his teacher. If there was a problem, that was his fault. He gave a very well-known lecture. It's called The Sages of India in Madras. In that lecture, he has traced the evolution of Vedantic thought in India. So he begins with the ancient Vedic sages. And then he describes the contributions of the succeeding generations of teachers and exponents like Buddha, Krishna, Rama, Buddha, Shankara, Chaitanya, and finally he comes to Sri Ramakrishna and so on. So he says, whatever spiritual philosophy he preached was a continuation, a part of the continuing succession of spiritual heritage of India. He emphasized again and again. But some Western thinkers, unlike the great genuine contributors like Paul Deussen, Max Muller and others, have tried to, and this is true in India also, many modern radical thinkers have tried to portray Vivekananda as something much less than what he was. If you want to give him a place, you have to give him the place one of the greatest spiritual teachers and prophets of India. But they take that spiritual aspect completely away from his teachings and reduce him to some kind of a social reformer. So that's an important point to remember. Now, if you analyze Vivekananda's contribution, you find four or five factors that determined his thought system. First, his traditional Sanskrit education, which he had when he was in his home, even when he was going to school, he had studied Sanskrit. So his acquaintance with some of the ancient Sanskrit scriptures. The second one was his modern education. As I mentioned earlier, Vivekananda refers to some of the teachings that inspired him that he was familiar with, like the teaching of Kant, Spinoza, J.S. Mill, Schopenhauer, Hume, and others. This egalitarianism and also this humanism, many of these ideas he must have imbibed from 19th century Western humanistic thinkers. So they played a very important role in forming his views on social reform and also certain views like the importance of eradicating poverty and illiteracy among the women folk and the poor people, etc. Another important factor that formulated his thought system was his training under Sri Ramakrishna, the training he received for almost 5 years under his great teacher Sri Ramakrishna, Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. The third important factor was his love for his motherland. Because he traveled in India almost from 1886 to 1893, just before he started his journey to America. He was traveling in India. So as he traveled, he found different types of people. So he says that two pictures of India used to flash through his mind. One was the picture of ancient India. The other was the picture of the contemporary India, what he saw before his own eyes, a country that lost its political sovereignty, which has stooped in elite, which has become divisive economically and socially backward, and quarrelsome without a sense of unity or with a sense of common purpose. And especially the youngsters who got modern education from universities and colleges started by the East India Company learned to be ashamed of their own roots. So he comes heavily on them. So if you read Vivekananda, some Western readers may be surprised. You know, he talks about the need for social unity, national unity, national reform, and the need for economic prosperity and so on. On one occasion, somebody put this question, was Vivekananda was just a patriot? Then I said, Vivekananda's love for India was just a fraction of his greater love for the whole humanity. So when he found in front of his eyes a country that was steeped in poverty, illiteracy, and superstitions. And he also, when he remembered the ancient glory of the same country, which I read just now. See, to produce a document like this, which I read just now, on women's empowerment in Mahabharata, you can imagine what a level of refinement, social, economic refinement that country must have reached in those ancient times. So Vivekananda was trying to come out with a unique concept of nation building, with a unique concept of education, with a unique concept of social reform. So he said, a country, a society, to be prosperous and to be able to sustain its heritage and spiritual tradition should have not only pride in its ancient values, but also should have economic prosperity, social stability, and a sense of unity and organization. Without secular prosperity, without material prosperity, no society can flourish, whatever may be its great spiritual tradition. So that was one unique aspect of his social philosophy. And also he said, an educational system to be effective should be a synthesis and harmony of the best of the modern, Western, scientific, technological, and also the ancient Indian or oriental spiritual values. This is true of maybe for the whole world, maybe for maybe today in American or so in European context, we can say, for example, if you evolve an educational system which is exclusively dependent upon, fully oriented towards science and technology, without giving any importance to humanities. Let us say in the context of America and Europe, Vivekananda perhaps would have said, we have to introduce then the philosophy of ancient Greece, the humanistic values of ancient Greece, Athens or Sparta or Rome, also should be introduced along with modern science and technology. That's what would have stated maybe in the context of modern Europe or America. In India's context, Swamiji said, India needed, on the one hand, the tools for economic prosperity, social stability, and at the same time, this should be done without sacrificing its own spiritual values. So this concept of harmony and synthesis of modern, Western, scientific, technological on the one hand, and the traditional spiritual values on the other, without any friction among them, without any friction. In fact, if you imitate, it leads to friction. So there is a statement in Vivekananda's literature, imitation is death. You should imbibe, not imitate. And actually he has something to say about Japan. What Vivekananda says is something very interesting. I have a statement here. He says, Swamiji was lost in admiration of Japan. He says, Japan has solved the problem, he says. See, in 1853 or 54, Commodore Perry came to Japan and Japanese emperor had to open his harbor for trade. So then they suddenly found out that Japan was very backward in all areas of science and technology in the middle of 19th century. So when they realized the need for it, they quickly rebuilt their country. They rebuilt a new navy which actually defeated Russia in 1905, Japanese Russo War. So within a very few years, Japan became a superpower of those days, comparable to Britain or America. So Vivekananda says, imbibing of values from another tradition should be done in a very harmonious manner, without any friction. So every nation, every society, every country, every race has its own special contribution to make the totality of human civilization. There is no nation in the world which has not made some unique contribution to the totality of world civilization. So there should be a natural, friction-free synthesis and harmonization of values from different cultures, different societies, different traditions and civilizations. So this concept of harmonization without friction was a unique feature of Vivekananda's philosophy of social reform and also his philosophy of education. So I have tried to give you just a brief description of some of the important features of Vivekananda. I want to repeat again, Vivekananda was not an academic philosopher the way you may approach Hume or Locke or Kant or Hegel. Even while talking about Indian philosophy or Vedanta philosophy, he was very much concerned about the people living in the streets, about people living in the farms. That's why he's talking about the need to eradicate social injustices, the need to build a healthy, prosperous and stable society which doesn't forget its own traditional roots. So this is just a brief overview of Vivekananda's contribution to world thought. Thank you. Namaskar.